Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a longstanding journalist of health, the environment, food, media, and popular attitudes and beliefs, covering a range of topics that affect our well-being, our place in the world, our place in our communities, and our place on planet Earth. And so on the show, I talk to different authors, advocates, filmmakers, poets, doctors, scientists, journalists, about the different facets of our interconnected world, all of which go together to support us in our context and in our communities and families and ways of being. And so the show has been going on. It's heading into its eighth year pretty soon. We've just had a wonderful series of guests. Want to point you to the Connect the Dots archives, where this program will be found, as well as all of our other shows reaching back over a number of years, and that is at connectthedots.podbean.com. Because I'm in the Northeast where the baked beans come from, so Podbean. On today's show, I'm really thrilled to have with us a returning guest, a fellow writer and contemplator, Mary Reynolds Thompson. Mary is a facilitator of poetry therapy and a pioneer in the emerging field of spiritual ecology. She speaks and teaches around the world on the importance of connecting to our inner wild. An instructor for Tree Sisters, a nonprofit with a dual mission of empowering women and reforesting the tropics. That's a really great combination. Mary also serves as core faculty for the Therapeutic Writing Institute, the leading training institute for expressive writing therapy. Her book, Reclaiming the Wild Soul, How Earth's Landscapes Restore Us to Wholeness, won a Nautilus Award a couple of years ago. She's also the founder of Live Your Wild Soul Story. And actually, Mary was previously on the show discussing Reclaiming the Wild Soul, and we had a great conversation back then, and have, you know, been connected ever since, or maybe even before, on Facebook, where there's a lot of public conversation, and even more so over the last couple of weeks, because of our because of our need to really interact on a societal level, but also manage some of the turns. You know, some of them difficult and some of them hopeful, that our society, you know, some of the incredible growing and pains and some of the devolutionary pains that our society has been going through. And there's a great opportunity in the social media to both follow that process wherever it goes together, to be active and engaged rather than kind of shrinking away in fear from some of the fearful and dreadful elements of it together, to, you know, together in conversation with others, to try to figure out ways to make the right kinds of shifts and the right kinds of interventions as citizens, as collectives, as communities of different people, in dialogue and exploration and processing, you know, amongst ourselves all together. And so that's one of the great opportunities of social media, especially on Facebook. And in over the last couple of weeks, in which there has been mounting concern over the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh for a position, you know, a seat on the Supreme Court, given his ideological background, history, and relationships and beliefs, you know, over the last couple of weeks, there has been this mounting concern. I've been tracking that a great deal on my Facebook page, as other people have too, and a number, as the conversation, you know, there are many reasons why, and we may discuss them on the show, why progressives, liberals, women, environmentalists, people of color, you know, there are many, many reasons why people, immigrants, you know, families of immigrants, there are many reasons why people are concerned about his accession you know, his proposed accession to the Supreme Court. But in most recently, allegations of an attempted rape episode from his deeper past have surfaced, and so it really has brought even more so women to the forefront of engaging with the attempt to kind of railroad him through into the position. So, you know, Mary wrote an absolutely beautiful piece in the last couple of days, which moved me greatly. I reposted it on my wall. A number, you know, my friends, and we have many crossover friends, you know, were also very moved and liked it very much. And, we kind of came up with the idea of why don't we talk about this together, because this entire situation requires a lot of careful thought and emotional processing because, you know, and we'll kind of go into that more. So that's kind of what we're going to be doing today on the show, something a little unconventional. Warm welcome again for your second appearance here in dialogue with me on Connect the Dots, Mary Reynolds Thompson.
Oh, thank you so much, Allison. It's really good to be back with you.
You know, there are so many different kind of threads, and I think we can kind of refer to what's going on, and if people need or want more information, it certainly is all around us, and we both are commenting extensively on our Facebook pages, and, you know, people can also go there if they're missing some factual links, where, you know, we post different reports and opinions and current updates about all of what's going on there, but we may also be referring to them throughout our conversation. You know, one of the things that I've been feeling at this particular juncture is how it's, you know, it's really falling to women to address this multi, you know, this kind of this issue of this nomination. And of course, we're not completely alone, but because of these rape allegations, women have been brought front and center into this dialogue and this intervention. So I thought maybe what we'd discuss first is, you know, what the upsides of that are, what the downsides of that are, and then after we've kind of explored that for a bit, we can also go into what some of the other ramifications are, because we originally began our prior conversation because we both are environmentalists and environmentally focused, and that's the even bigger picture, in a sense. So, you know, let's begin with that. I'd love, you know, some of your thoughts about both the opportunity and the challenge of women and, you know, the now really being at the heart of the concerns about Brett Kavanaugh's nomination.
Yeah, that's such a great question. And, you know, two things occur to me immediately. One is it's always interested me that, well, not interested me, disturbed me would be a better word, that the victim somehow has to be the one responsible for solving the problem. So here we are again. Women who are the ones who have been sexually abused, who have suffered so many occasions where their boundaries have not been respected in any which way, are now again, of course, responsible for solving this problem. And it is so interesting to me to see how men are not stepping up to own that as the perpetrators, they are the ones who should be responsible for cleaning these things up. And yet, once again, we see them stepping away from that responsibility. And if I may, my mind wants to leap to this image of, do you remember, I mean, gosh, I don't know, was it 6 weeks ago, 2 months ago? It's hard to tell now the way life moves. the incredible story of the young boys being rescued from the cave.
Yes,
right?
Of course. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So when I look back at that, I think one of the reasons it so powerfully captured our imagination was that we saw something that we so rarely see in our culture now, the truly responsible, caring, dynamic masculine at work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, going into the cave, we could talk all the symbolism about that, and drawing these boys out with such love, such care, such bravery, such courage, such sensitivity. And it was like suddenly we went, oh my goodness, here's this model of what the masculine should be doing, protecting, taking action to protect. And now we look at this situation with, you know, the committee, but with the whole Republican Party, where they are absolutely absconding from their responsibilities. And it is such a toxic model of masculinity. It you know, when we compare those two things, it's really quite shocking to see how incredibly toxic the Republican Party has become. And it's a male-dominated, white male-dominated, old white male-dominated party.
Indeed. You know, one of the things that I have been pointing out is that, you know, men who are feeling exposed in their past behavior, I mean, you know, they identify with him, and therefore, you know, they're not coming forward and saying, I did this, you know, but they are secretly and privately, no doubt, remembering, and this is not every man on the planet, but of course, but there are, you know, I'm sure many men who may be reflecting back on past experiences where they did things that were condoned at the time and are perhaps still condoned by certain groups of people, but which maybe they now are recognizing was crossing a line of disrespect and even harm that they never knew was there. Or maybe they're just newly recalling experiences that they had never reexamined. And so this could be, feel, very threatening. So instead of the sense of I, you know, have handled this part of myself, or I never behaved this way because I was better brought up and better cared for and, you know, had loving models, which some people are fortunate to have and others don't, therefore, you know, they are unready and in resistance, and or some of them are. The ones that we're seeing in the Republican Party are highly defensive. They're not ready. They feel threatened. They feel frightened. They're terrified of the pushback from, you know, women whom they have disrespected or denigrated are now, you know, stepping up to, you know, not dominate them in the same way, but any step out of that subservient role could be experienced as, you know, an act of aggression, because that's how, you know, they're aggressive. So if they have to kind of give way even a little, that can feel incredibly disempowering, anxiety-provoking, and a number, you know, of different columnists and journalists have commented on the fact that people feel that way. And, of course, their bonding with each other, which is their support group, consists of bonding in some places and in some cases, like the Catholic Church is an example. Kavanaugh is a graduate of Georgetown Prep. You know, but in some places, it's the bonding with your peer group occurs over doing these kinds of things to someone else. You know, and so they don't have the benefit of the kinds of supportive conversations and dialogues that women have that would help them process what they themselves have done and ready them to be caring and, you know, and humble themselves in order to make it right. And so instead, there's this, it's like a, you know, the cat that ran up the tree and can't get down.
Yes, I know what you mean. You do feel that there are a large number of men right now feeling cornered and perhaps in their heart of hearts deeply ashamed. You know, it was interesting, about a year ago I was a panelist at the Conference of World Affairs, and one of the panels I was on was called It's Just Locker Room Talk, and of course it was referring to Trump saying, you know, he grabs women in this gross and inappropriate way, and was it okay if it was just talk? That's how the boys talk, right? And so it was very interesting. We were all, there were three women and one male on the panel, and the male said, the trouble is, and I think this is in part what you're referring to, is that the culture for male bonding is so often around this false machismo and domination of women and this sort of sexual conquest and all of these things. Oftentimes, boys don't actually want to be brought into that kind of a world, but they are afraid not to, because if they don't join in with that kind of circle of, you know, conquest and I had her and blah, 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 we know what that sounds like, they themselves become the object of bullying and are sort of outsiders. So I think hugely that we have to change the culture, you know, within our schools at a much earlier age. But we know that a lot of these older guys right now grew up where they honestly probably don't see anything particularly wrong with what Kavanaugh is alleged with doing. You know, they were in similar situations themselves and never actually thought it was wrong, because that's what guys were supposed to do. They were supposed to get the better of women. And, of course, not all men, but I do think there's an awful lot of rationalizing going on. Well, it was so long ago, you know, he was drunk, you know, so that means that, you know, that, you know, means he's not responsible, we don't have to hold him accountable, on and on and on. And the thing is,
it also means that his denial that he absolutely did nothing is dishonest, because if he drank as much as, you know, as is known that he did at the time, then, you know, if he was that drunk, he doesn't recall what he did, very likely, if he did or if he didn't. So it's very disingenuous to categorically deny, which is just this sort of strategic posture, when in fact he probably doesn't know, and he probably doesn't remember, and even if he were semi-conscious of what had happened, his take on who a woman was, like the women, in talking about, somebody was alleging that maybe she was mistaking him for another guy. You know, the women are very clear on who these individuals were, even going back 30 years. And the men, because of the objectification of women, are kind of hazy about it. You know, I don't remember her, you know.
Yeah. That's a really interesting point. I actually hadn't thought about that, but you're absolutely right. It's like we're nameless, voiceless, featureless, and yet we remember the men very particularly. So that's a very interesting point about objectifying women. One woman is as good as any other, right? So that in itself is a way of vanquishing. I mean, as you know from the piece that I wrote, the piece that it's like the abuse that's happening now feels as egregious or even worse than the alleged abuse that happened all those years ago. And what I see is, you know, this culture of
domination. Can you describe that for our listeners, Mary, who, you know, exactly what you mean by the abuse that is happening now? If you could just describe that a little bit for any listeners that might be unfamiliar with it.
Right. Well, the way I equated it, Dr. Ford described Kavanaugh as literally putting his body over hers, grinding her down, grinding against her, and then putting his hand over her mouth when she attempted to cry for help. And so what I saw when the committee started to address this allegation was exactly the same thing happening. So in other words, they were overpowering Dr. Ford. They were giving her no room to make her own decisions. They were throwing the full weight, really, of the Republican Senate against her. And they were doing, in a way, everything they could to silence her, to put their hand over her mouth by essentially saying, you know, you're going to speak in this way, this is how it's going to be done, and we're going to rush it through on Monday, no, we're not going to have an investigation. So all of this way that in a metaphoric way, they were repeating the alleged rape. And that, in a sense, was the thing that spurred me to write, because I could feel it viscerally in my body, as I believe many women do, this oppression of the male to the female, the shutting her down, the silence her, you know, let the little lady have her say and we will go on our way. You know, just, I feel very strongly that this is a time when women's voices are coming forth, are needing to be heard. But I also understand the depth of the courage of that, because we have been silenced every which way. And right now, that's exactly what's happening. And the only reason they're doing any accommodations is that they're looking forward to the November elections and thinking we cannot, you know, essentially offend too many women. If it wasn't for that, there would be no accommodation for Dr. Ford at all.
That is true. And, you know, the irony of it, of course, is that, it was also true back in 1991 when Anita Hill was the person making accusations of harassment against Supreme Court nominee Clarence Thomas. And, you know, I, at the time, was trying to rally support for her because I was able to identify, which I think people who were paying attention, I don't think it was a rare insight, but not everybody was paying attention to the kind of judge that Clarence Thomas would be, and that we have seen that he has been in the intervening, you know, 17 years. And yet there were many people who were tuned out on that. Women were kind of more apolitical. It's not my domain. No one wants to hear from me. And there was such a pervasive disempowerment about being engaged to have any influence. You know, it all was just, we're spectators. The, you know, there's a sports team, the Republicans versus the Democrats. Who has the most numbers? My say, my word, my influence, my outreach as a citizen matters not and does not count. As we move forward, you know, to today, 17 years later, lo and behold, it turns out that, you know, the plaintiff, as it were, although she's not legally a plaintiff in this case, but the person intervening on behalf of the country is, you know, an alleged victim of rape. But she also, in those intervening years, has become an incredibly successful and skilled academic, psychologist, researcher, scientist. And so, you know, these guys who are very, you know, these Republican senators who are incredibly unhumbled, unapologetic, filled with their tremendous sense of entitlement and their huge agenda that they're trying to enact, are actually not only having to face up to the victims of this modus operandi, but this specific person is, you know, has been skilled by psychological understanding. She is protected, you know, and working with a coterie of, you know, attorneys who are knowledgeable about the legality, all of the legalities which they kind of flout. And, you know, so she is a much better armed, as it were, and you know, as these are professional women who are now together and in opposition to this and acting for the truth to be known. Or if the truth cannot be ultimate, there, you know, and the whole purpose of asking for an investigation, I mean, an investigation is standard operating procedure. So at all points, many points throughout this nomination and hearing process, the senators have felt completely free to flout precedent, to do whatever they feel like without regard for the law. This would always be accompanied by an investigation. And because, on the other side, because Americans, many Americans, are not well informed, they haven't been well educated, they're not knowledgeable about legalities and history, then they are themselves not clear and subject to manipulation. Oh, she's being uppity, asking for an investigation. Somebody, you know, it could be portrayed that way through a media lens, and people who are not well informed would not know that, in fact, it's really the overstepping of authority to not provide that. So, you know, the upside is that there are highly skilled people in doing this, and the downside is that we're dealing with a population that has been in many different ways confused. You know, not everybody, certainly, but a certain segment of it. Go ahead.
I didn't want to interrupt you there. No, it's interesting when you talk about the FBI investigation. I saw Anita Hill being interviewed on the PBS NewsHour the other night, and she was saying this idea, you know, the idea that, oh, this happened 35 years ago, therefore you can't possibly find any evidence, you know, there's no point in an investigation, it's far too long ago, etc. She said it's such a fallacy that essentially, and they also say, of course, well, he's already been investigated by the FBI. But it's an entirely different thing to investigate a specific incident. And always, and nearly always, as Anita Hill was saying, you can find evidence. If you actually looked directly at a specific incident, there is evidence to be found. And the FBI are expert at this. And it doesn't have to take years and years and years, or months and months and months. They can go about their business very quickly and efficiently. So I totally agree with you. This whole thing that it's, you know, not appropriate to investigate this is completely bogus. And it also really speaks, I think, to a fear that if it's investigated, a lot of stuff, whether it's immediately related to this incident or alleged incident or not, is going to emerge about Kavanaugh, and it's not going to be pretty. I mean, it's already breaking through, right? You know, he belonged to some very inappropriate clubs, his drinking was excessive, et cetera. So this paragon of virtue that has been displayed before us is shedding, you know, a few of its little gilded lilies at the moment. The other thing that really strikes me is we live in archetypal times, right? So when you were talking, Alison, about, you know, the quality of, I never know whether it's Blasey Ford, is it Blasey Ford, which is why I'm saying Dr. Ford, because I'm not quite sure how to pronounce it.
Yeah, I don't know either.
Is, you know, here is, as you said, this incredible, not that I don't love Stormy Daniels, because I do love Stormy Daniels. I think she's a powerful feminist, too. But here is a woman of such a different kind of substance against this man who, if he is elected, let us not forget, is going to very likely overturn Roe versus Wade. He's going to be responsible in tipping the balance, dictating what women can do with their own bodies. And God knows what else will emerge in terms of, you know, we've all been watching avidly The Handmaid's Tale, right? You know, and we're beginning to live, you know, all these dystopian things that we thought were somewhere way off in the future are now looming big in our psyches and our souls. So here we have, there again, this play out of this powerful, intelligent, substantial, you know, woman against this man who really feels to me in so many ways so much smaller than he is being presented to be. And it's, you know, we're watching this play out in so many different ways and scenarios. We're watching it in a way, it's David Goliath moments all over. You know, Black Lives Matter, the Me Too movement, the women's marches, the, you know, in every which way, where people of substance are coming up towards this huge shadow and naming truth to power.
Yes, beautiful. Yes, that's exactly right. And the other thing is that it's both individuals who emerge, but it's also the support of the community and the collective. And so, you know, the difference in the male bonding, which is around, you know, this covert and unconscious and, you know, inebriated behavior, you know, directed toward women, to, you know, as a source of their own fragile sense of empowerment, versus, you know, the coping skills, the relational skills, the circle, you know, and support skills that psychologists have developed, that healers have developed, that women have developed, you know, over centuries in order to cope in, you know, situations where, you know, they don't have this tremendous entitlement and, you know, power supporting their role, but where they have to cope with be on the coping side of carrying the burden of this, these inequities, you know, in effect. And so you also have a situation, another moment of this that I just loved was that the minute that Dr. Ford made her allegations, you know, within less than a day, the Republican Judiciary Committee senators had at the ready 65 women to, you know, standing by to attest to his, to, you know, nominee Kavanaugh's character. And, you know, it's like obviously they were aware of these allegations, or why, or perhaps there are other allegations, you know, in the offing that they were ready to deter with this, you know, contrived shield of women that they had recruited, you know. And then, you know, when the true nature of what was going on was known, in fact, all but two of these women completely recanted and stepped away from it. And instead, you know, you had Dr. Ford's classmates from the Holton Arms School, which she was attending when this incident occurred, you know, a girls' school, prep school, you know, all rallying in support, you know, and standing with her and signing letters in her support and, you know, hosting press conferences and events to support her. It's like, you know, the hidden strength of the women's, you know, the girls' network. And all of that, you know, even from you know, from the teenage years. And so I loved that, that
it
particular
is, and, you know,
play.
It's so interesting. I know, like, they all appeared like these 65 women, like little elves in the forest all of a sudden. I mean, it was so completely transparently orchestrated. But it brings us back to this larger issue for me of this whole disregard for truth.
Yes.
I mean, what happens when you literally are being sort of administered by people who have no regard for the truth? They don't care.
Right.
And this, that, you know, that everything is fabricated. Everything is about essentially fooling people, lying to people, burying the truth, which is what they're trying to do now, right? And altering the truth. And so we live in this sort of gaslighted world, right, where we're all going a little crazy because we are being fed lie after lie, and they're good at it. There are all kinds of subtleties. You know, really bad liars, you can see through them. But when they're they bond together. You were talking this wonderful thing about women bonding together, which I think is beautiful, and it's absolutely happening. And this, I believe, is we are a force to be reckoned with, and we're already beginning to see that. But the Republican Party have been absolutely masterful at bonding together around their lies. They stay on message. They stay on story. They don't break rank. You know, wishy-washy glorious liberals and Democrats, you know, we're all over the map, right? And because I think truth, in a way, is all over the map. There doesn't tend to be one absolute truth. There are many subtle, nuanced, particular truths. But this monolithic lying is terrifying, and we know where it's taking us. It's destroying our democracy, but it's also driving us all a little insane, I think.
That's really true. And also, it becomes hard. I mean, one of the things that I value about Senator Bernie Sanders, and perhaps he'll be the candidate in 2020, but he's already does yeoman service and continues to do it from his independent stance within the Senate and, the U.S. legislature and everything. He represents what I call, and he's not the only one, but he's been long-term and consistent in doing this, what I call true north. In other words, you can set a compass by his values. They're not deviating. He keeps pointing in the same direction and going to the heart of the problems afflicting us in terms of both, what the diagnosis is and what the cure is in order to help people. And so one of the reasons that people, so many people are taken by him, trust him, and continue to trust him is because he has that faculty of speaking the truth in the situation, and I call it as like a compass, true north. Because I generally, for example, do not take in news from television very much. I read almost everything. I read a lot of different sources, and I dialogue with people, but I don't really sit down and watch any of these television programs on the television or on video or at any time. And the reason for that is that my first career was as a filmmaker, and I worked in mainstream television, among other things. I was first a documentary filmmaker, then I wound up in TV news. And so the kind of shaping, the manipulation, the choices, we'll talk about this, we won't talk about that, all the stuff that people have become more aware of, and they want to point the finger at the other side and say, that's fake news, no, you're fake news, no, you're fake news. What I have seen from behind the scenes very early on is the manipulation of all news. And also the power of televised news with its personalities and with the kind of seductive, hypnotic power of television to influence our biology and take us in and along on the ride that they want us to go on. And people passively accede to this as entertainment, not knowing that they're actually being influenced, manipulated, and I would even use the word brainwashed. And then this, too, creates an atmosphere where there's tremendous confusion and crosstalk about what constitutes and spin about what constitutes reality, So
absolutely,
even well-intentioned people can wind up thinking things like, well, she came forward so late because, that's what the news media, someone is talking about, and then it becomes like a valid point through being repeated, even though everyone that has dealt with, this kind of trauma, this kind of abuse and victimization, manifold, a majority, undoubtedly, of women in America have been through these kinds of experiences. So, we know a lot about them, and we know how the legal system treats them. So, of course, from a female perspective, which isn't as equally represented, of course, in the media, everybody knows why it might take somebody years to come forward, why they might be reluctant, why it might happen at the 11th hour, not to mention the fact that she already had consistently, once his nomination was on track, had begun to kind of move in this direction with all of the reluctance of the danger the lack of protection that her stepping up has cost her and her family in reality. And yet, you know, people will hear this spin and go, it must be contrived. Why did she come so late to the table with this? Even though practically this is what happens with most victims, and the percentage of reported cases that turn out to be bogus or contrived is extremely low because of the reluctance to face a hostile system that
absolutely
won't believe you.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, to think for her that there's an upside for this is really, really hard. You know, to your point about watching the news versus reading the news, I agree with you. I mean, I think video is, you know, the images and film is so powerful. But I have to say, you know, I also see even many of my friends posting totally bogus written pieces, articles that come from completely false, you know, bogus kind of organizations that call themselves news feeds. So I think we're really in a crisis of not knowing, you know, what's fake, what's real. I mean, I almost always check out, if I don't know absolutely where the source is, I, you know, go on Snoops or whatever it's called and check it out, because it's, you know, I want to know where my news is coming from and where it's rooted. And I think that takes time and energy, but we all really have to be responsible for that. The other thing that you really bring up when you talk about Bernie is one of the key characters in this drama that we're seeing played out is Susan Collins. And I would say she is the antithesis, right? You know, here is this woman who always comes out as though she's this moderate swing vote, you know, is really with this gentle voice, you know, the soft feminine, and you go, there's hope on the horizon. And then, you know, 2 seconds later, she's pendulum swinging, I'll say, back in the other direction and voting along party lines. And, you know, and I see that with Flake and Corker, and I'm like, what? Come off it, guys, that this timidity of you wanting it both ways, that you're going to be the voice of reason and courage, speaking out for thing, and then within 2 seconds, you go rushing back into the comfort of the Republican cave. And it just, it drives me mad, because it's just part of the problem. It's like people wanting to be perceived to be free thinkers, right? But they're not free thinkers.
Well, you know, that's a really excellent point, and I think Susan Collins is maddening, really, you know.
Maddening.
Maddening. You know, it's just... But you know what? It harkens back. Part of what's it, there's many we could unpack that one for a while, I'm sure. But part of it is that it's an anachronism. The Republican Party of my youth, which I recall, or even the neoliberal Democratic Party of my, you know, of recent times, you know, the middle way, so called, of the Clinton years, you know, where, oh, we're going to be bipartisan. We're going to stand in the middle. We will craft something that works for both sides, you know. And so there is this sense of, like, you know, the soft spot of the happy compromise, and we can all work together, and, you know, it can be worked out, and we all have to give a little, and then we can, you know, and if we all compromise a little, all will be well. I mean, this was the myth that was sold us, you know, part and parcel with neoliberalism. And so Susan Collins' position reminds me of that. It's like, oh, we just have to be genteel with everyone. We must listen to them. They have a point of view, too. And yet that really ignores the fact that from the Clinton, well, from the Reagan years really onward, but certainly through the Clinton years, this is what pushed or pulled the Democratic Party rightward and rightward and further rightward, until, you know, there are a certain range of topics, you know, pro-choice being one of them, where the Democrats take a stand on domestic issues. But then, you know, there's a whole host of other topics where they really go along with the Republicans, and they've been pulled along. And, you know, and they've gotten more and more and more powerful. So, you know, this position of the happy compromise has gotten a lot of people rooting for a team that has betrayed itself, betrayed the American people, and is in a losing position. And as they stand in that position, and it's extremely critical during this, you know, these hearings, you know, people are then sitting back and saying, well, they don't have the numbers. What can we do? And it's like, we got there because we kept compromising.
Right. This is and gerrymandering evolution. And a whole load of other things that have been, you know, and the fact that we don't live in a democracy, truly. I mean, we could go there too. You know, one of the things that really strikes me, I don't know if you're familiar with a mythologist called Michael Mead. He does a lot of amazing work. But one of the things he talks about, and I think this is part of the bigger thing, he talks about the end of times. Now, he's not talking about the rapture or anything like that. What he's really talking about is the great unraveling, you know, the great turning that's going on, the fact that all our systems, our political systems, our economic systems, our systems of justice, et cetera, are essentially being dismantled, that we can see them. They're not working anymore, right? And that's the end of times. In other words, we're living, I think many of us sense, in a moment that is deeply pivotal. And what he talks about is that in those moments, there is no center. The center falls away, and people get further and further apart. So we've got this radicalization, essentially, on both ends of the spectrum. And what he says is part of our challenge is to hold the tension of that, to live in that dynamic, tense, uncomfortable place, without collapsing into it, so that the new can emerge. And I think, you know, when we go back to what's happening with Dr. Ford and Kavanaugh, we are back to one of those core issues. You know, are we women going to be dictated to by powerful men who can tell us what to do with our bodies? You know, are white, you know, people going to continue to control what happens in terms of race and the injustices and economic injustice and all of these things? And it's one of these moments where, you know, whichever side you fall on, you are clinging on to that end of it, because for dear life, in a way, wondering what the heck is going to happen, because whatever is going to happen is we're either going to swing way back from whence we came, which is the feeling that's going on now. We're just going to go back into the 1950s, right? All this progress is over, or something new is going to emerge. And we're all, you know, certainly we, you, I would imagine, are hoping that out of this incredible, tense, agonizing time, there's going to be the opportunity for a new way to arise.
Yes. And, you know, and it could look quite different. I mean, we may have intimations, but we don't know how it will look. You know, one of the things that I don't know why this comes to my mind as we're talking about this exactly, but I guess it is apropos, is there was a recent, I was just reading a NBC Wall Street Journal study where they looked at people's disposition toward the Kavanaugh nomination, and, you know, they found that the majority at this point have crossed the line and do not support the nomination. And then they looked at it along party lines, and unsurprisingly, you know, there were changes in both party things. In other words, there are some people on the right who, you know, are not holding firm on insisting upon the nomination, and there are indeed people on the liberal moderate left side who, you know, have increased their, who were maybe, oh, well, maybe, and, you know, now they are like, no, I don't like this, you know?
Right.
When they were describing that, I think the figures came out to be 38% against 34% for, and 28% I don't know. And so I was wondering, and they said that also the people who are pushing the hardest against this are, you know, mature people, elder people,
Dads,
women.
That's the same
obviously.
Thing, right? Women over 50 and people
yeah.
over 50.
And they're,
yeah.
So I was wondering, because so, like, for example, the people, the activists who've been protesting in the Senate hearing room itself, and who've been going into Senator Grassley's office and, you know, sitting in there, and who've been in the building, and their numbers are growing every day. They were actually dressed up as handmaidens for, you know, for one of their appearances.
Yes.
This is, you know, kind of very dramatic civil disobedience, and it's been covered in the media. And, of course, they know how to cooperate and be arrested, you know, if that's when the police are there to do that, and so this has been going on. But you know, so these are younger people actually, and so what this leads me to wonder is, where are the millennials in this? They are, you know, the newer voices and the newer opportunity. Where are they in the 28%? Were they not even surveyed? You know, do they kind of feel like the system is rotten, and I'm not even going to get engaged around this because, of course, it's terrible? You know, I wonder where they are, because obviously, in some ways, the new way, you know, will in part be theirs to define, too. I mean, do you have any sense of that?
Well, you know, that's a great question. I don't actually know if millennials are engaged with this or not. What I do suspect is that if you're a woman of 50 or older,
mm-hmm.
or anywhere between 40, 50, you've had the experience of being abused in some way sexually, whether it's, you know, on the job, in,
mm-hmm.
You know, at a party. In other words, while we were saying earlier that many of the men deciding this thing to a great extent actually can go back in their memories and think, well, my gosh, you know, I behave like that Kavanaugh's alleged to have behaved, and it's not such a big deal. We go back as women and think, that could have been me, you know? That
mm-hmm.
really could have been
mm-hmm.
me. And so mm-hmm. I feel that perhaps there's a real passion there, that just because of who she is, when it happened, we relate. It's our time zone. It's, you know, we can put ourselves very easily back in her situation. But I don't know. You know, I'm always, when I meet younger women now, and I've been working a lot with them through this Tree Sisters organization that you mentioned at the beginning, is there's a fierceness about them. I mean, they...
Mm-hmm.
There's a power, there's a way that they are rooted in themselves as
mm-hmm.
human beings that I couldn't have imagined as being so completely sort of self-determined and self-composed at their age. And so, I don't know, maybe
yes.
emotionally the story doesn't engage them as much.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Well,
and yet I have a friend who works, in the tech world, who says, oh my gosh, this is just, and we've read all the articles about it too, right? So we know this kind of behavior is still obviously so pervasive and going on. I don't know.
Well, I think it is pervasive, and I think it's really kind of bad now, because they also have like a kind of group and party culture
right.
that, you know, I don't think they're immune at all, or that it's lightened up in some ways. It may even be worse. I mean, I've sometimes had the impression that it is worse because it's, you know, it's rawer where
yeah.
it may have been more hidden before. So, you know, I think they are participating. I don't know if they're being polled, actually. So I think there may be, you know, I think they may be not fully accounted for yet, and that, you know, the new wave and the shift will also be, articulated by them.
Definitely.
Yeah. I mean, do we have any, we have about another 6 minutes, you know, before we'll be wrapped up. Do you have any, you know, kind of intimations of what the new wave will will kind of look like, you know, or would be like for us to kind of, you know, kind of have in mind as we gird our loins and go back into, you know, the coming weeks in which this entire matter will be decided.
Well, I don't obviously have any crystal ball, as, you know, obviously none of us do, but one of the things that I am hoping passionately for, and I'm seeing it all over the place, is essentially a breakdown of the patriarchal power over model. You know, this is what's essentially been so exaggerated. This is the image that's been flung out of us with Trump, with Kavanaugh, this absolute patriarchy power down model. And I don't think that's going to continue. I think that's the thing that is really in the process of crumbling. And I believe deeply that it is women, and not just women in the Western culture, but women all across the globe, who are going to be responsible for shifting the paradigm to, as you talked about, that collaborative, cooperative, interdependent paradigm, where we all realize that we're all in this together. And to me, you know, okay, so I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. But logically, it's what else is going to shift anything, right? I mean, if we stay in this, you know, hierarchical, power down, essentially white male dominated world, nothing is going to change. It's like, you know, shifting furniture on the Titanic. So something has to shift, and I think it is what I call in my work the wild feminine. It's the feminine connected to earth, connected to themselves, connected to each other, you know, not worried about gender and, you know, race and all of these things, because there's a deeper sense of we're all in this together. You know, all those awful separations and clarifications and boundaries and all of us in our separate silos, no more. Because I think the feminine vision is really, as you talked about before, it's about community. You know, we survive and thrive together, or we don't, and it's our choice. So for me, that's what I'm hoping for, that all of these things that we're seeing and experiencing, which are so painful and stressful and hard and exhausting, so many of us are truly feeling exhausted, really are the end of something. What we're seeing is the hospicing of the old way of being.
Amen. Well, we've been talking with Mary Reynolds Thompson, a dialogue show. We always have dialogues, but this is kind of a true batting it back and forth at this crucial turning. It's been a pleasure having you on the show. You can find her on Facebook, Mary Reynolds Thompson, and follow some of her beautiful writing there. And tell us your website as well, where people can find you, Mary.
Sure, it's just MaryReynoldsThompson.com.
Yeah, and you can find her books there, and her blogs there, and events and teaching that she's doing to participate in. So thank you so much for being with us today. It's really been an amazing conversation. I loved it. I feel like we should be doing this with the show all the time somehow.
Thank you so much, Allison. It's really been quite the adventure.
And you know, listeners, if you like this show, after you've listened to it live, you can find it at the connectthedots.podbean.com. Share it with your friends. Look us both up on Facebook. And, you know, hold hands and we'll keep marching forward. That's, you know, I sort of change the tagline every week. Thank you for being with us on this edition of Connect the Dots. We'll be back next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Allison Rose Levy.